Who the Wild Things Are with Ryan McGuire.
You gotta listen to your body.
Oh my God, maybe, you know, I could get out there. I could do this.
Let's take a ride. Find your wild side. Real stories. See with your own eyes.
It's so beautiful.
I'm gonna have the best time out here.
Yeah, I was in tears. I was just like, that's the best, man.
Welcome back to Who the Wild Things Are. My name is Ryan McGuire, and I'm here to bring you conversations with the most wild folks on the planet. If you're enjoying the podcast, please leave us a rating and review on your podcast platform of choice. And if you enjoy the episode, share it with a friend. Appreciate you guys. Let's get it going. Well, this is definitely kind of a dream come true for me to have you on here. I've been listening to your stories for a long time, and just really excited that you decided to spend the afternoon with me.
For sure, man. Yeah.
So how's the new shoe coming?
Good. It's out in the world. It's pretty good. People seem to like it. I love it. There's two of them. There's a trail shoe and a road shoe, and I've been kind of switching them back and forth, wearing both of them a lot. I'm actually going to go out this morning for a trail run in the road shoe, just because I kind of like the road shoe on the trails.
Yeah, I like a shoe that, like a road shoe that can still handle trails. That's kind of my sweet spot.
Yeah, especially for rocks. You know, shoes with lugs aren't really that good on stone, and a lot of trails, like where you really want it, like, listen, I can handle mud one way or the other, but where I really want some traction is on stone, you know, particularly coming downhill on those big slabs. And so a good road shoe is actually designed to grab on slippery asphalt, so it works just as well on slippery rocks.
Cool. Well, I'm definitely planning on testing out the Zero shoes before you know it.
Yeah,
that's my next purchase.
All right.
So, Chris, I think a lot of people kind of know you now as the Born to Run guy, but I think it would be interesting to kind of hear about how all this started. I'm curious just to hit square one. Where was Christopher McDougall before running was even in the picture?
Well, I could take it back quite a ways, but I'll try and hit a couple of good timeline points. And I think the main one was out of college, I was an English major, and the first job I got was as an English teacher in a high school. And I realized probably within minutes, this was a big mistake because I never really liked being in school. You know, I would get by in school because I was pretty good at like kind of thinking on my feet, making up bullshit answers, improvising, you know, like reading the room and sort of picking up from what other people were saying, what answers were. So I basically just kind of faked my way through school. But I like to read, like that was my thing. So then I get out of college and like, all right, English major, English teacher, but I hated it. I just hated being in a classroom. And so as soon as that year ended, I bolted for Europe with some buddies, and I was getting my teacher pay through the summer. So I was living off of teacher pay and just backpacking around Europe, and got to Spain and liked it and stayed there and started finding odd jobs. I was a scene shifter for a theater company. I was a warehouse dude, got some work teaching English, and eventually was able to, again, rely on that same fake it till you make it thing that I had honed back in high school. I got a job as a reporter for the Associated Press. They were hiring people who spoke the language and had some ability to write a little bit. So I got a job at the Associated Press and ended up becoming a overseas correspondent for the Associated Press. Held that job for a bunch of years, which was kind of my sweet spot because it is a job that is like custom made for acute ADHD. Like if you can't sit still, if you can't focus for more than 30 minutes, get a job as a foreign correspondent because you're all over the place. Ended up going from Madrid over to Lisbon, and I was the Lisbon correspondent, and then in Africa. So I was covering conflicts in Africa, politics, news, and sports in Portugal and Spain. banged around doing that. Like, running was nowhere on my radar. I was a big dude. I'd been a basketball player and rower. So the idea of like doing long, slow distance did not appeal to me at all. And when I did, I got hurt. And so my sort of future to me was going to be bopping from one story to the next. You know, I went from news into magazine writing. And that's where I kind of was until I heard about this tribe in Mexico. I thought I'll scoot on down there, do a quick in and out story for Runner's World about this, you know, unknown tribe. And what happened was one of those illuminating light bulb moments when you realize, oh, the world does not work the way you think it does. Things are different. And to me, that revelation was everything I'd always been told about the sport of running was bullshit. It was just wrong. It was just make-believe. It was just marketing. And that may not seem like a big deal, but to me it was a big deal because, you know, I had written a lot for Runner's World and the same kind of things I had repeated as like gospel truths. You know, you got to have the right kind of shoes. You have to go to a running specialty store and have your gait analyzed. You need either motion control or stability. You know, pronation is bad. Change your shoes every 300 to 500 miles. Don't change your natural gait. Everybody runs differently. You know, so use your own like natural gait. Don't try to change your gait. All these things. Oh, and then running's bad for you. You know, running's basically bad for the body. The most you can hope for is to minimize the damage. You know, but it's like falling off of a roof. You know, you're going to hit the ground and all you can do is hope for the best. But you are going to hit the ground and it's going to hurt. And that essentially was the attitude around running, which is that this is bad for the body. It's bad for the knees. You're going to get arthritis. You know, you're going to have injuries. And all you can do is hope that you can minimize, keep these things at bay as long as possible. But then, you know, I spent time in the Copper Canyon and I just see one thing after the other that is completely the opposite of this. And it makes me realize, oh no, everybody is just regurgitating the same nonsense.
Yep.
And that's what got me intrigued. It wasn't the running that got me intrigued. It was the kind of challenging of received wisdom. Because I kept thinking, boy, if this is all bullshit, like what else is bullshit? Like what else is out there that we're being sold on?
It's incredible now too, just in the last few years, you're mentioning, you know, it was just damage mitigation. But now it's even to the point where osteoporosis doctors are prescribing long distance running to increase bone density. And like 10 years ago, that would have been the most anti-medical advice that you could possibly receive.
Yeah. You know, I tell you, Ryan, it's if you start to become aware of the wellness and fitness trends, you start to see the cycle, which is that on a 10-year basis, everything that is carved in stone today will be reversed in 10 years. You know, I grew up in the 70s and 80s where do not eat eggs, stay away from red meat, fat is bad, fat is bad. And then like, oh no, sorry, we were completely wrong about all that stuff. You know, I grew up, you know, when sugared cereals were okay. Every breakfast table had a selection of sugared cereals because those were okay because they were fortified with vitamins. They were a bowl full of sugar, you know? So I think where this has led me ultimately is even if something agrees with my thinking, I assume it's wrong unless I can find a very, very long tail. If I can find a heritage of a trend that dates back not just dozens of years, but thousands of years, then I think we're on to something.
Yeah, it's hard to argue with the old ways if they have, you know, many, many chapters of existence.
You know, I'll give you an example of that. So I was in New York a while back and a buddy of mine who lives there says, hey, man, you want to go to one of the steam baths, you know, on Lower East Side. There's the old Russian baths on the Lower East Side. I'm like, yeah, I'll check it out. And, you know, you get down to these places and they've been around. These things have been around since the 1800s. A lot of them are like the same buildings. And the experience was fantastic because you have all these different rooms, steam rooms, some with like sprues, and some with like a hot steam, some with like a dry heat. and the cold plunge pool. But what really got me was, after you've been going in and out of the pool, you've been steaming and jumping into the cold baths, you can go to a refreshment bar and buy a beverage and then go up on the roof and sit in the sun to drink your beverage. And he's like, hey, try this. And it was salt water. You buy a bottle of salt water. I'm like, dude, I want something refreshing. He's like, try this. When you are depleted, you drink the salt water and it tastes sweet. And then as your salt levels stabilize again, it starts to taste salty and sour. And he's like, yep. Your body is telling you what it needs. And the fact that we're doing these cold plunges. So now like Wim Hof and, you know, Laird Hamilton, everyone else is so into cold plunges, which is cool. But there's such a heritage of this dating back thousands of years, you know. Yeah. Caesar was doing cold plunges.
Yeah. Yeah. The salt thing is interesting. I just did a 24-hour event this past weekend, and all of my sodium intake I do based on taste. So I know immediately if like my, I use Element, which is a salt brand, but if it tastes good, I know I'm really depleted. And then the minute it tastes bad, I know that I don't need it anymore. And it works just as simply as that.
You know, I was crewing for Luis Escobar at Badwater 1 year, almost 20 years ago now. And he had this really cool nutritionist with him, Sonny Blendy. And I think I mentioned like in the acknowledgments or something of Born to Run. And, you know, Sonny had this phrase that an ultramarathon is basically just an eating and drinking contest with some scenery and exercise thrown in. And I watched her during the course of this 135 miles, basically just try different foods on Lewis. So it was not based on a plan. Like, okay, you got to have this goo and you got to have this supplement. You got to have this thing. It was like, hey, how's the melon taste? Oh, you spit it out? How about a piece of fried chicken? That tastes good? Okay. Grease it is. So I think it really it tunes into that your animal metabolism is going to seek out what it wants.
Yeah, I've heard my friends call it like a 50-mile buffet.
Yeah,
you know, right. You just bounce from spot to spot, stuffing your face with as much food as possible.
Yeah. Yeah. Did you hear Lucia Bartholomew talk about her first ultramarathon? You know, she gets into this thing where she, you know, because she'd been a competitive runner. And then as a teenager, she's like, what? You can go slow and talk to people and eat whatever you want in a race? Like, sign me up.
I'm in.
Yeah.
So your story kind of progresses into learning about these folks in the Copper Canyons. And I was very into, still am very into primitive skills and, you know, the natural way of running and spending a lot of time in nature. And I had done some research on them and had learned about this guy who ends up being kind of the anti-hero of Born to Run. So I'm curious what your interaction with him, if any, was like, because I feel like typically with Born to Run, you talk about all the cool heroes, right? You talk about Caballo Blanco, you talk about, you know, the crazy stories of Barefoot Ted, but rarely do you hear about the sort of villain of the story.
Oh, you talk about the guy who originally brought them up to Leadville?
That's right.
Boy, it's been a while and I don't even remember his name off the top of my head.
Fisher, right?
Rick Fisher. That was it. Yeah. You know, here's the deal. So here's where Born to Run came from. I had, heard about the tribe, went down to the Copper Canyon, spent a little time, met Caballo, knew this race was going to come in 9 months, but there really wasn't a story there for me because, well, I didn't really learn much from Caballo. I didn't really learn much from the Tarahumara. And this race that was going to take place wasn't going to happen for another 9 months or more. And so I didn't really have a reportable story for Runner's World. But I did have a friend who was an editor for 5280 magazine in Denver. Max Potter. So I called Max up and said, hey, man, do you know about this tribe and like these races that they were in Colorado in the 90s? He's like, yeah, I know a little bit about them. Like, you want to do a story? And to me, the story was about like xenophobia and racism in Colorado. Like, my thinking was, hey man, if the Lakers win the title, then the Lakers are the defending champion, and everybody wants to see the defending champion return next year. So here you have a group that kicked the living crap out of everybody 2 years in a row, and then they never come back again. So to me, my assumption was, well, this must be these race guys, you know, the race directors in Leadville, Colorado, must not have invited them back, must have not wanted them back because they were embarrassing the American runners. That was my assumption. So the story I pitched to 5280 is, we should do a big, like, blow the lid off of this kind of prejudice that is excluding the most talented runners in favor of the homegrown runners. So I'm going to go to Leadville and go after the race directors and see what they have to say, which I did. So I call up and I make contact with Merrill Lee and Ken Klober and go down to Leadville. And within about 90 seconds, I realized I am so far off the mark. Like, my assumption was so effing wrong. Because I sit down and talk to Ken, and he's like, I'd love to have him back. I don't care. We'll give him free room. It's like, anytime. I'll have him over my house for dinner. They were great. You know, those guys were fantastic. The guy that brought him, on the other hand, you know, I'm ready to ride that guy out of town on a rail. And what convinced me was everybody attached to the race, it were so casual and off the cuff about this. And then when you go to Leadville, again, I'm coming from a big urban marathon perspective. Like, if you want to talk to somebody from the Boston Marathon, New York City Marathon, good effing luck. You know, you're gonna work your way through PR people and all kinds of like different layers. Leadville, you just walk in the walk into the office and see who's around. You know, oh hey, there's Ken. Let's grab a coffee and talk. So it's such a mom and pop feel to the Leadville Trail 100. At least it was back then. So I talked to Ken and said, hey, why is it, hard-hitting reporter, you know, why is it that this group has not been invited back? He's like, they're invited back anytime they want to come. Love to have them. They're fantastic. Mark Timano, guy's fucking hilarious, you know? But yeah, he goes, but the guy who brought them, we weren't a fan of. And then I spent time and lived and realized, okay, the story I'm going to write is the opposite story. It's not why the race excluded them. It's why it was not a good match. Why people were taking this group out of their comfort zone and then bringing them to the U.S. to essentially be exhibition items. You know, it was kind of the thing that was happening back in the colonial era, you know, where, you know, English explorers would come to America and take indigenous people back to Britain, saying, you know, look at the noble savage. So that's what my original article, actually, I think the first article I ever wrote about any of this was for 5280. And so, you know, with Rick, I sort of don't recall even now looking back on the reporting. I remember talking to him, his ex-wife, saw a ton of video, talked to a lot of people involved. And, you know, ultimately, I don't know, it's hard to see what's in someone's soul, what they're doing. I'm sure Rick can make a case for why he thought he was doing the best. I remember his ex-wife was a very compassionate person, and it's hard to imagine that she would do things that she thought were harmful. But, you know, also when you get into high-pressure situations, all kinds of stuff comes out, you know, of your behavior. So I'm not sure if I'm giving you a good answer here, Ryan, but that's kind of where I'm at with it. But I think ultimately what it was another guy who was on the scene at the time. You had Ken Klober, you had Rick Fisher. But you also had the guy in the shadows. You had the old Mike Catrue, who was there and was pacing the Daromada and was seeing what was going on as a fly on the wall. And it stuck in his mind, hey, man, if I ever do a race, I'm not doing it this way.
Yeah. Yeah, and so for anybody listening that isn't familiar, Mike Catrue, a.k.a. Caballo Blanco, those are the same person, so it might be a little bit confusing, but ultimately, he's kind of the figurehead that seems to unite the two worlds, right? You have this reclusive tribe of super athletes that can run hundreds of miles. You have kind of the gringos, and then you have Mike Catrue, who is a once gringo and became more reclusive ultra runner as his life went on. So just a little bit of background there on the story itself. Did I do a good job of summing that up, or?
You did. You did. Although I was just actually kind of smiling to myself, like, you were able to summarize it a lot faster than it took me to figure it out. Because this guy was one cagey pain in the ass, man. You know, it took me 2 years to find out his actual name. His actual name isn't even Micah True. It's Michael Randall Hickman. And
yeah, I heard that actually. Like at the recent, someone was giving a keynote at that Micah True or Caballo Blanco Ultra, and they said a different name. I'm like, oh, he's got three names.
Yeah. And I only found that out because he had mentioned he was a character, dude, a character with a capital C. You know, not many of them, you know, roll across your horizon in your lifetime. And usually when they do, you're so busy dealing with them that you don't take the step back to realize, oh, like, relish this moment because you are in the presence of a true one-off. But you know who got it? Lewis got it. Jen Shelton got it. Billy Barnett got it. Like, they really enjoyed, they enjoyed Barefoot Ted, and they enjoyed Micah a lot. I was aggravated by both of them. And it's a life lesson. So the person who gave that talk was Lewis. And not only did he appreciate Caballo, but he would have Caballo stay at his house. The number of people who have rocked up, you know, I don't know if you know Kat Bradley, Western States champion, like 2017, she like dropped out of college to go live at Lewis's house. Caballo would live at Lewis's house. Barefoot Ted stays at Lewis's house. I've stayed at Lewis's house. Lewis and his wife Beverly are running this kind of like youth hostel for wandering, wandering ultra running ding dongs. But I'm leading you straight. When I met Caballo, he went by Caballo, and then he went by Micah, and then he mentioned he had been a fighter, a professional fighter, in the Colorado area back in the 80s. And so I went to Denver Public Library and started like digging through newspapers, started doing a clip search, you know, an old school clip search, and I came across a picture of a guy, but the guy went by the Gypsy Cowboy. They're like, well, who's the Gypsy Cowboy? Oh, well, the Gypsy Cowboy is Michael Randall Hickman. But I'm looking at the picture, like, that's the dude. But he's going by Michael Randall Hickman. And so I sent him the picture. I said, hey, man, is this you? And he's like, oh, what the fuck are you doing? It's private. What are you doing? And like, is it you or is it not you? Yeah, man, that's me, but it was a different time. So his real name was Michael Randall Hickman, a.k.a. Gypsy Cowboy, a.k.a. Micah True, a.k.a. Caballo Blanco.
That's incredible. And so you get wind to him, and you have the opportunity to go down there. I don't think many people necessarily understand the vastness of the Copper Canyons. What was going through your mind? Kind of like, you're just a normal guy trying to investigate this story. You're kind of in uncharted territory at that point. What was going through your head in terms of traveling down there?
Yeah, I think denial is probably the most important virtue. Ignorance and denial are the best two things you can have going into life. Because if I had known, or I had actually come to terms with reality, I wouldn't have done a lot of this stuff. But, you know, I had started my writing career as a foreign correspondent, which meant basically always showing up in places where you don't know what's going on. You plunge into a story, you got to figure it out on the fly. You know, it's jump off the roof and learn to flap your wings on the way down. And so I was kind of used to that. Like, you know, rush off, figure it out, get the article, run back and write it. And then you get into magazine freelancing, which is that on steroids, because you know, you're competing with a lot of other freelancers. And so you got to call an editor up and say, hey, man, I heard about this tribe in Mexico. And they're like, are they legit? Oh, yeah, they're legit. Are you going to have access? Oh, yeah, I've got access. You lie, you know. You say, oh, yeah, you promise all this shit, because an editor doesn't want to contract the story if they don't think you can actually get the story. So you got to pretend you know all this stuff, right, when you don't. And you figure, I'll figure it out when I get there. And that was basically my mentality. As I was in Mexico already on another assignment, I mean, I'll just rip off, do this one real quick, get double pay, you know, for the same amount of time. And I hadn't researched anything. I had no clue how incredibly gargantuan that. It's like going into the Copper Canyon is like being lost at sea in a life raft. You know, man, you're in the middle of nowhere. And the guy, the only guy I could find that would take me, really didn't know what the hell he was doing. And nobody ever mentioned the obvious fact that a place that's hard to reach would be a great place for drug cartels to operate. So I didn't know any of that stuff. If I had, you know, might I have made other choices? Probably, yeah. I probably wouldn't have bothered, you know. I would have assumed the odds of me finding anything were too slim. So I probably would have just bailed and moved on to a different story.
Yeah, that's a good point, though. I think there's something to that. Having ignorance about a situation or not knowing exactly what's going to go down. Do you think, I mean, nobody would ever run their first 100-mile race if they knew exactly how bad it was going to hurt. Like, there's no way you could put yourself through that.
It's a weird trick of the mind, because going into it, you're like, well, it can't be that bad. And then at mile 80, like, oh my God, it's so much worse. And then you finish and you go, never again. And then 2 hours later, you're making plans for the next one. It's insane how your mind refuses.
Ride.
Yeah, your mind refuses to see what's really happening. Only for one brief moment, like at mile 75, do you realize, oh, this is what it really is. And then as soon as you're done, it just fades and you're good to go again.
You know, you get down there and you start to make these connections. One thing that I'm really curious about is how the whole group from Born to Run came together. You know, for people that have read it, people that haven't read it, you know, it just becomes this very unique group of athletes all pursuing kind of this really unique and remote ultramarathon. But there's no clear reason that group was aligned. There's nothing that ties you all together. You're not from the same place. You're not the same age. You're not all the same nationality. You know, there is not really any one thing you can point to. So I'm curious kind of what it was that tied that group together.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I think the glue is invisible, but there's a glue. But from the outside, you got these two ding-dong hard-partying surfers from Virginia Beach. You got the reigning, the god of ultramarathoning, Scott Jurek, you know, who's like the LeBron of the sport at that time. You
His
got
book is right on the book stand in front of me.
Yeah, you got Barefoot Ted, who's just this, you know, wandering, yapping dude who likes to go barefoot. You got Luis Escobar, who's really a family portrait photographer. This is early in his career before he became a really well-known adventure sports photographer. Back then, he was just doing prom pictures. You got a journalist who's can't run, is in over his head. You got a coach who is basically down here to watch. So it's all, as you said, completely different elements, different parts of the country, different experiences and motivations. But I think the glue revealed itself to me recently when we were working on the sequel, actually, Born to Run 2, because after Born to Run, I always thought, boy, isn't it remarkable that not only do we have this adventure together, but we stayed together. Like, we've become important parts of each other's lives ever since. And so, you know, I was kind of curious about that. Like, huh, was it just a weird trick of fate that these seven people happen to rock up on Gilligan's Island and seem to get along? Or is there something self-selective that put us there in the first place? And I got the answer when we worked on Born to Run 2, because one of my goals for Born to Run 2 was I wanted this book to be really visual. I did not want to try to make the argument in words that running should be communal and joyful and diverse. I wanted to smack people right in the face with it. I wanted them to open the book and on every single page see pictures of people of color, people of different genders, of people who are gender non-binary, people running with dogs, people running with kids, people running with prosthetics. Every single page, I wanted to hit this message. Yes, everybody is born to run. Everybody. And so we got together, this hodgepodge of people, just this kind of Hail Mary thing of like, hey, anybody know somebody, you know, who runs with a prosthetic? Hey, anybody know somebody who's who's a trans runner, you know, who's gay, who's older, who's younger, who's big, who's small? Let's get these people together. And none of us had ever met more than one or the other before. So it's like 10 people together. And at most, each person maybe knew one other person or knew nobody. And we had such a ball that weekend getting together for this photo shoot. 10 strangers. And if you see the cover photo of Born to Run 2, to me, there was no question that that was a cover photo because everybody looked so happy together. And also, ironically, that I was not in the picture because I ran down as usual to like tell Lewis what to do. And I forgot to run back up in time. So I think the thing about it is that the glue is that sense of pleasure for pleasure's sake.
Yeah.
Why was Scott York in the bottom of his canyon for this wacky ass backyard race run by this weird hermit? Because Scott is all about the run, you know? Mm. That's why he's all over the goddamn place too. You know, Badwater, Western States, Hard Rock, you know, whatever that one is. Is it Spartathlon? Not Spartathlon. Is it Spartathlon? Whatever the one is in Greece. Scott's all over the place, you know?
Yeah.
And so Barefoot Ted, all over the place. Jen and Billy, all over the place. I think the thing about it is they love the joy, the adventure, the other people. And that's what got us there in the first place.
I think it's a really interesting thing because there is kind of two frames of mind, and maybe these exist in everyone, which is the grind it out, stay hard, you know, kind of self-punishment attitude of running or fitness. And then there's like the happy-go-lucky enjoyment, out for the experience, looking at the birds school of thought. And it seems like the Born to Run group really kind of falls into that latter group.
Yeah, but that Born to Run group wins races too. And they stay around for a long time.
Yeah, so there's... So it's interesting because you would think that that happy-go-lucky thing corresponds with like lower performance. But your point is that you can have just as high performance with also enjoying it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm so against that whole, you know, stay hard mentality. I think it's actually the root of everything that's wrong in America today. You know, be tough, you know, win, beat the other guy, you know, be as hard as you can. Don't care about anything except the win. And if you want to really look at everything in the, you know, I don't want to make this like too global a response to your question. But to me, if you look at everything that is the problematic in the United States today, it's about shitting on the other guy to get what's yours. Mm. About being hard. What does being hard mean? It means about caring about nothing except yourself and your win. Even if it means putting yourself in the emergency room. You know, because you put yourself in the emergency room, that puts a lot of other people at risk. You know, if you run hard until you collapse on the trail, well, that means someone's got to find your ass on the trail, get you off the trail, get you to the hospital. People who care about you are worried. Other people are putting themselves at risk. Why? Because of your ego. You know, because you have to be hard. And when you look at all the things that are problematic in the United States today, I'm not taking a vaccine, you know, not me. I got my freedoms. You can't take my guns away. I got my freedom. I'm going to stay hard. You know, all that kind of shit. About lying and cheating and stealing in order to get an advantage, but you're cool because you got the win. You're touching a nerve right now because someone who lives very close to me, one of my neighbors, is a major Fox television talking head. And she comes out against trans people, against people who want to control guns. And every time I see her, I just saw her this morning, and it drives me crazy because this attitude of like, you know, we're going to do what we want and you can't stop us attitude drive me insane. And so that might not seem like a direct response to your question about the two schools, the Be Hard versus the Born to Runs. But let's look at it this way, Ryan. Anything that you don't want to do, at some point you will stop. And this has been proven with every kind of discipline. This whole idea of like people putting themselves on forced diets. You know, I'm just going to only eat 1,000 calories a day and I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to. At some point, you're just going to quit, you know? And it's the same with running programs. I think the most, the biggest reason why people look at running as something unpleasant is because it is unpleasant. They do a negative downward spiral like, oh, you know what? I ate ice cream last night. I'm going to have to run today. And then you're going to run to the point where you're uncomfortable because if I'm uncomfortable, I must be doing something good. I must be burning off those calories. And then you're going to be sore and you're going to be on the verge of injury. And at some point, you're going to quit the activity. Now look at the other way. What if you're on an upward cycle? Like, you know what? I'm going to go out with my brother, go for a run. And we're going to talk about my mom and complain about my mom for 2 miles. But we're going to run so slowly that we can keep the conversation going. And we're only going to run until we don't feel like it anymore. Then we're going to stop. And then we're going to have a coffee and walk back. So the Stay Hard school is like, well, you just didn't do anything, you know? But the Born to Run school is like, you know what? I can't wait to do that tomorrow. That was fun. And your buddy wants to come back. He had a good time too. It becomes a reinforcing upward cycle as opposed to a negative downward cycle of, you know, pain and dissatisfaction.
Yeah, I think there's something to that. I would push back a little bit and say that some of my times where I have the most fun with a run are after a really hard run. I get this amazing burst of catecholamines. My dopamine shoots way up. I'm excited. I'm calling people from high school that I haven't talked to in a long time because I feel like talking to people. I'm so excited. But really, I just did an 8x1000 workout where I was running much faster than I normally would. And now I've like spiked up so high. And even though it sucked in the moment, I'm having a lot of fun after that.
For sure. And listen, man, I'm all about that. Like I said, you know, born to run runners win races. You know, Scott Jordan will never tell you that, hey, man, my 7th Western States was a walk in the park. No, I'm sure it's hard as shit, you know. Bad water, just that course is hard as hell. There's an extreme amount of discomfort that comes with it. But, you know, I think the dividing line is what you got out of it was the pleasure. You were uncomfortable in the moment. You were pushing yourself into distress states. But your motivation was, I'm here to enjoy. I'm not here to go to the hospital, you know. You're not here to collapse. You were here for those breakthroughs. You know, sure. And the breakthrough is not breakdowns.
Yeah, that's a good point. We just did, this just makes me think of this past weekend. We did a 24-hour bike, assault bike. Have you ever seen an assault bike? You kind of use the hands and the legs. It's a fan bike.
No. You know what I'm talking about? Yeah, but it sounds horrible.
Yeah, it was rough. I did it for 24 hours. And
good gravy, dude.
It definitely sucked, but during it, I had a bunch of people next to me, pacing me, and a lot of them biked the furthest they had ever biked in their life, and it turned out to be like there was a lot of fun times. In the middle of the night, there was no one there at 4 a.m., so the police, like the local police department, sent people there, and there was policemen on the bike next to me, and you know, we were all partying, even though it was kind of miserable.
Yeah, you know, I did an event a couple of years back. It was a 24-hour stair climb in Philadelphia. Ooh. You know what, dude? It was so fun. I loved it. Yeah, and I think it was probably very similar in some ways to your assault bike 24-hour. It was on the Art Museum steps in Philadelphia, you know, the Rocky steps. And, you know, it starts off at like 5 in the morning. And you go through all those, you know, phases of the sun and the moon. Sun's up, it's hot as hell, but someone bought a bunch of water ice. And, you know, you had like the best water ice you ever had in your life is at like noon on an August day. And then when it gets dark out, suddenly it's cool and the city lights are coming up. And yes, physical exhaustion, but you're having these moments. Well, I had this experience recently when I went out for a run and I was high up on a trail and it was totally exposed, it was above tree line, and all of a sudden this ripping storm comes through. And I'm like, oh well, this is just your life for the next hour because there's nothing you can do. There's no shelter and you're on the trail. So you gotta just keep going. And my first thought was like, God, you're so stupid, you know. And then my second thought was like, wait a minute. You're the only one in the world having this experience right now. There's nobody else up here and you're in it and you are unique in the world. So like the rain's coming down, the wind, but I'm looking around thinking, okay, it's kind of cool. Like this is like being the first dude on planet Mars. Like you're the only one having this experience and like enjoy the suckiness of it.
Yeah, I actually, that's a good point. I wanted to ask you, how has your running slash fitness slash health journey changed since becoming the author of, like, I don't know, maybe the biggest running book ever? Has it turned you more into an athlete? Have you done a lot of races since then? Have you kind of gotten burnt out on it? What are your feelings towards running and fitness in general?
Well, you know, it's funny. Eric Orton, the guy who coached me for Born to Run and has kind of intermittently coached me ever since, reminded me of something. So this whole idea for Born to Run 2 came out of the fact that I get a lot of messages from people asking me for advice. And I would just never answer because I'm not a coach. You know, I write about coaches, but I'm not the guy with the knowledge. And then I was relating this to Eric one time. We're talking on the phone. And like, yeah, somebody was asking me again, like, you know, what shoes? And you know, I'm not going to answer. And he's like, why not? You've been a 15-year experiment, man. It's coming on 20 years. And now you're in a position where you can actually tell people what works for you. And I didn't really have that perspective. Like, I wasn't aware of how much time had gone by. And he said, do you remember the first conversation we had? I said to you, if I could give you a magic wand and turn you into any kind of runner you want to be, what is it? What kind of runner do you want to be? And, you know, the magic wand question is a perplexing one because at first you're like, oh, yeah, I want to win the Olympics, you know. I want to qualify for Boston. But when you actually ask yourself the question, like, I don't really give a shit about qualifying for Boston. Olympic medal, I don't even watch the Olympics. Like, what do I really want as a runner? And it's a great question. And my answer to him then was, you know, dude, I just want to be able to walk out the door and run as far as I want in any direction I want, whenever I want. Like, that's all I want. I want the ability to say, hey, man, you know what? It's a sunny day. Oh, that mountain looks cool. I'm heading that way. Or you know what? Hey, it's kind of a cloudy day. I think I'm just going to go short. Whatever I want to do in the moment. And he said, okay, man, it's been 20 years and mission accomplished. Like, that's what I do. And so what I got today is exactly what I wanted back then, was that ability. Because, you know, I got my run planned out today. So early this morning, I went down to this beach. I was trying to body surf. The waves were garbage. And the only reason I rushed back, so dude, I would have missed this conversation by a lot longer, because if the waves had been good, my thought was I didn't need to be back here until noon my time. But the waves are mush. So I said, you know, screw that. I'm going to rush back, eat a quick peanut butter and jelly, and then I have this real cool trail that I want to run today. I'm going to run that 2-hour trail and be back just in time for Ryan. And then I found out, no, actually, I had the time wrong. But so my goal for today is, all right, the waves are garbage, so I'm going to pivot. And there's this trail that I really like. I'm going to go run that as soon as I'm free.
Hell yeah. How far is it?
It's not far. I mean, I go right out my door. It's probably a 10-mile loop. You know, but
okay, so you're putting some serious miles still.
You know what? That word right there, serious, doesn't feel serious at all. Because I know the route, I'm gonna meander it, and there's a guy that sells fresh tuna out of his front yard on the way back. So I'm gonna bring my wallet and buy some fish. You know, it's like in my mind, this is a fun run.
Yeah, I guess, substantial mileage is a better word than serious. Like, you know, you're making it sound super effortless, but for 99% of people in this country, they hear 10 miles and that is an unconquerable feat.
Yeah, and I look at that and think, you know, maybe not so much. Maybe the 10 miles is unconquerable because of the expectations we put on ourselves. So
Yeah.
I don't want to minimize it, but I bet you a lot more people could do 10 miles if they told themselves, okay, you know what, I'm going to walk a mile and I'm going to jog a couple miles and then I'm going to climb a trail and then I'm going to get some ice cream on the way back. You know, like if it just
Yeah.
became just by any means necessary. There's a crew, Run for Chinatown, that is pushing hard in New York to get more Asian Americans involved in running. And I every time I say they're the most fun running club, I then remember like five other clubs that are also fun. But Run for Chinatown is among the most fun running clubs around because they run over to Manhattan Bridge, the sun's going down, everyone's talking, they're watching the lights come up over New York. People are laughing, and then they always pick a Chinese restaurant, and the whole crew just crowds in and they order their faces off. And a lot of people are running a lot farther than they ever expected really quick because of the joy this group brings to it.
Yeah, that's a big thing is explaining to people, especially new runners, that it isn't about running fast. It's just about going out and enjoying the day and finding out what your style is. You know, we're all built different. You're a bigger guy, I'm a bigger guy. Neither of us are gonna be running sub three marathons this year at Boston. You know, we're just not gonna do that. But, you know, I think my style is probably pretty similar to yours, which is kind of more adventure running, freedom running, if you will. You know, I really like to go out and go far and just see what's out there.
Yeah. And people mistake that for, you know, like laziness or not trying hard. But like you said, I don't think I've ever finished a workout that didn't feel like it was at least 30 minutes longer than I wanted. You know, like every time I go out, like, why aren't, how come I'm not done already? You know, like since we moved to Hawaii, I got into outrigger canoe paddling. And I feel like I've never come in with my canoe where I didn't feel like, God damn it, why didn't I come in half an hour earlier? You know, why am I still out here? But that's kind of cool. You're always pushing your limits, but it's the freedom that gets you into those predicaments where you're exploring your boundaries. Because I go out
Yeah.
for a paddle, I'm like, oh, hey, look at that island over there. I wonder if I can get there. We'll see how long it takes. You know, like I'm not trying to do it for time. I'm not trying to set any records. I'm just curious. And that curiosity always gets you into a predicament. You're like, oh shit, you know, looks like I'll be working harder than I wanted to.
Yeah, that's kind of the beauty and the curse of the adventure running is sometimes you get in over your head a little bit, which is probably good for us.
Yeah. I think it's why you sign up for a 24-hour assault bike. Have you done anything like that, either that length or on that kind of a bike before?
No, I'm not a biker at all. I actually hurt my feet snowshoeing, and all I could do was the stationary bike. So I pretty much just said, huh, I wonder how far I can go in 24 hours. And it turns out the answer is 426 miles. So that's the answer. Now we know. Now I don't have to do it again.
Yeah, but I guarantee you will. Guaranteed. Yeah, because you're like, oh, you know what? If I only had done this, I could have gone 500. Like in your mind, like, oh, yeah, I learned a lot. Why not try it again?
Yeah, maybe. We'll see. I don't know. That one I feel like maybe I'll never do again. Like I love 24-hour runs or I would even like boat maybe for 24 hours, but stationary bike is miserable 'cause you're inside the whole time. I don't think I've been inside for 24 hours in years. Like I don't remember the last time I'd ever been inside
Isn't
for 24 hours.
that cool to think about? Yeah, I'm kind of the same way, man. The sun's up, I'm out the door.
Yeah, I don't want to be inside anymore than I have to be. So that was yeah, maybe one and done on that one.
Right.
Christopher, one question I have, you know, or I think, you know, a lot of people have is what led you to shift gears going from Born to Run 1, which is very much an epic and a novel and a story, like a hero's tale, to something that's much more a practical guide and practicing certain methods in Born to Run 2. What was the thought process there?
There are two things. One is that I thought that, well, when Born to Run first came out, it didn't initially make much of an impact. You know, it wasn't reviewed in any newspapers. Runner's World wasn't going to touch it. And I wasn't getting on, like, you know, Fresh Air with Terry Gross or CBS Sunday Morning. I really got no attention whatsoever. But it started to pick up a word of mouth kind of a thing. And it started to spread, you know, hand to hand. And that's what actually started to drive sales, was runners were telling other runners, people were telling, hey, man, you don't have to be a runner, check this book out. So it was purely a word of mouth phenomenon. And so, but I assumed, okay, man, you know what? It's going to have the shelf life of like ice cream. It's going to melt and vanish before you know it. But when things started to gain traction and the message came across, you know, run for joy, learn about your body, don't fall for the marketing, don't fall for the fancy shoes and the pronation, the orthotics, or that crap. Like, let your body express itself. Let the animal inside reveal itself. I thought that message would take over. And then what I saw over time was, oh man, we just reverted right back to where we were before. Cushion shoes, compression this, supplement that, all this junk you buy and buy and buy. And as you mentioned, like the whole, you know, stay hard message. And I just felt it was time to course correct and go back. And in Born to Run, I suggested ways to approach running. And in Born to Run 2, I'm like, I was actually going to spell it out. Like, here's what you can do. Because like in Born to Run, I was not advocating for minimal shoes. I wasn't even wearing them myself. Like, hey, there's this one guy that wears them. Here's what I know. Figure it out for yourselves. You know, like, I'm not a coach. Here's what this guy told me to do. We'll see whether it works. So Born to Run is told from the perspective of like, hey, I'm a newcomer in this field. I have no clue if I'm going to finish this race or not. Born to Run 2 is told from the perspective of like, hey, I've been in this now for 20 years. And I'm convinced that these things work. So if you want to ask me what shoe to wear, I'll tell you. If you want to ask me how to train for a race, I'll tell you. Because I feel that now I both personally experience and witness a lot of people who benefited from this approach.
Yeah, I think you definitely sell yourself short in terms of being somebody with enough credentials to speak on the matter. You know, I think maybe that's just because you're humble, but I mean, I think you definitely hold a position where folks want to know your opinion. They wouldn't ask you if they didn't, you know, they wouldn't be asking.
Yeah. Let me think about that for a second, because I think there are a lot of people who know a lot more than I do, but we're not hearing their voices. And so that's why I felt like, okay, I just assumed, I mean, it's true. There are people who know a lot more about running, training, coaching than I do, for sure. I just assumed that those people would rise to prominence over the past 10 years. And so, but they sort of haven't. So their voices haven't been amplified. So what Born to Run 2 really is me listening to Eric and then saying it louder. You know, like he's the voice in my ear and then me shouting it. That's what it really is.
But I here's the thing. Yes, there's plenty of people who know black and white running more than you do. You know, they know where to put the tally mark for the long run and the speed work and all that. But that's not why someone like me would come to you. I think the reason I look up to someone like you is because this combination of, yes, running experience, but also the ability to honor the old ways. You have this ability to bring both of those two things together, where you're recognizing that there is sports performance and modernity has improved on some of those aspects, but there's also a reason to relish in the past and what we've been doing for thousands of years. And I remember seeing specifically your TED talk talking about the persistence hunters and why it is that pregnant women are able to run so far, and why it is that old folks and 16-year-olds run roughly the same distance. And then, you know, there's the elite runners that kind of are centralized in age. And, you know, that entire message and really thinking about, oh, he really has studied like the anthropology behind running, not just the X's and O's of a training schedule.
Hey, Ryan, you know, it's funny. I just got my alert, my calendar alert, alerting me that our podcast interview is 1 hour from now.
Sweet.
Just to verify how badly I messed up on our timing. Thank you. So, no, yeah, okay. You know, maybe there is a benefit to that. You know, it's an outsider's perspective. You know, it's the Moneyball syndrome. It's not the same old coaches looking at players and deciding who should be the best baseball players. It's outsiders who are actually looking at hard facts and numbers and making a decision that way. And for me, you know, Outside Magazine just had yet another article about Eaton in Kenya and the birthplace of, you know, the greatest runners in the world. I'm like, oh, dude, like how many times we hear the same thing over and over? Yes, a high altitude subsistence environment will prepare people for marathons, but also it's because it is the basis of Kenya's economy is producing marathon runners who last two or three years and they burn out and vanish. And so, but they keep hitting the same point over again. It's faster, faster, faster. It got to be fast. The marathon, fast. And maybe to take an outsider real to look at the perspective, humans are not fast. Speed is not our great natural ability. It is our adaptability and our endurance and our collaboration. That's what makes us good. And so maybe that was it. Maybe I was bringing a perspective that was getting lost in this constant harping. So a couple of years ago, back when Nike was doing its 2-hour marathon project, a reporter called me up and wanted to interview me about, you know, 2-hour marathon. Like, you know, can we break us? Who gives a shit? Who cares? I don't care whether somebody does something a second faster than somebody else did something. We're always talking about speed. I don't care because that number means nothing. But you show me where 1 million new runners have begun going out every day. Now I'm interested, you know?
Yeah.
If Nike, instead of like, let's get break the 159.59, who gives a shit? But if you tell me Nike threw all of its weight around a running program that would teach proper running form and made a goal of getting 1 million new runners in the streets, like now I'm excited.
Yeah, that's awesome. I think really that's what your book did for a lot of people, though. I'm sure, I don't know what the actual numbers are, but I'm sure there's a massive, incalculable, you know, impression that book made on new runners. And I'm sure at this point it has surpassed anything that you could have expected.
Yeah, for sure. Well, you know, it's funny because you always have two things in your mind as a writer. It's probably the same thing that we experience in any kind of endurance event, which is like, yeah, I can do that. And part of your mind is like, no, you can't, you know, like, and it's that seesaw. So when I was working on Born to Run, I was thinking to myself, dude, if this book sucks, we know exactly who to blame. It's you, because the material is fantastic. You know, this is a great story. So if people don't like it, it's because you did a shitty job. And so part of my mind is like, this book should be really popular because it's a great story. But the other part of my mind is like, but who reads these days anyway? You know, books just don't last. So in some ways, it exceeded my practical, pragmatic analysis of the book market. But as far as my own, like, appreciation of what was there, it felt like, yeah, this is, because here's the thing about it was, back then, there was only one book that was really kind of fun, and that was Ultramarathon Man, you know, Dean Karnazes' book. That was the only book that was out there, like, oh, this is kind of cool. Like, Dean wrote a real rip snort and tale. And to me, the only thing Dean's story was missing was other people besides Dean. Like, if there had been more people in that book, it would have been a little bit more universal. And I think the one thing that was missing from Dean's tale was it wasn't accessible to the average person. Because you look at Dean, like, well, shoot, dude, I'm not going to roll up a pizza in a tube and eat it while I'm running 200 miles. You know, it's too much. And so there wasn't a universal access point where people could really identify with an otherwise really, really great book.
Yeah. How scary is that moment, you know, when you hit publish or when you hit send on a book like Born to Run that you put so much time and energy into? Was there like a lot of anxiety associated with, holy shit, I hope this turns out well?
You know, the anxiety is that you got it right. That's what the real anxiety is. I think I had enough publishing experience as a magazine freelancer and a news reporter where you realize, oh, nobody's really paying attention. Like, I was covering the genocide in Rwanda, and I was pretty much off grid for about 3 months where all my message traffic was one way. I had a satellite telex where I could send print copy back to HQ in New York, but it didn't receive messages. And so I would only get messages every couple of days when I could get on a sat phone and call the control bureau in Nairobi and talk to the bureau chief. So I was really kind of cut off. Like, I didn't really know what the news coverage was. And so I assumed after a couple of weeks that no one's paying any attention anymore. And I was actually shocked when I came out and go, oh, this is still front page news. Like, I had no idea, because I was just so used to, you know, you do a story and people just don't pay attention. And same with magazine articles. You know, you spend 3 months working on a story. To you, it's the best thing you ever did. And, you know, it goes out there in a couple of days, people forget about it. And so with the book, you're thinking the same thing. Like, okay, I hope people read it. They probably won't. I'm already thinking about the next project. Before, because, you know, you finish the manuscript and it's 9 months before the book is on the newsstand. Well, for me, I'm already on the next project. You know, I'm already working on Natural Born Heroes by that point. But the big abiding concern you have is, like, did I get this right? And, like, for instance, with Barefoot Ted, he bugged me so much down the Copper Canyons that I went to his house and hung out with him for a couple of weeks just to get to know him better, because I thought, am I missing something here with this guy? You know, because everybody else seems to like him, but he's like driving me bananas. And so I saw a side of him that I didn't appreciate down the Copper Canyons. And so, but when I write this portrayal of him, it's kind of, you know, in some ways, it's kind of mean. I'm kind of making fun of Ted. But I also feel like it's accurate. So that's the anxiety. The anxiety is, am I doing right by the people? Am I going hard when you got to go hard and kind when it's time to go kind?
Yeah, there's a lot of weight behind that, because you want it to have honesty. You want it to have emotion. But you also want to appease people. You don't want to just shit all over the people that are being so nice and being characters in your book.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I know that Anne Trason, for instance, is unhappy with her depiction in Born to Run. I feel like it's pretty. Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's funny because, you know, she's a very private person, and I reached out to her a bunch of times and had no luck getting in contact with her, but I had a ton of video footage of the Leadville race and another interviews. So I based a lot of what I wrote based on what was like in the public domain. But yeah, she was unhappy with it. And again, it caught me by surprise. I thought the depiction of her was kind of heroic. I thought she was an ass kicker and super, you know, legendary. But she was unhappy with it. And then I realized, okay, that's just the way it goes. Not everyone's going to agree with the way you see things. But it also made me realize, you know, writing books, it's not photography, it's painting. You know, you're creating an impression of what you see. It's not a pixelated recreation of a moment. It is an impression that's been filtered through our brain and comes back out again.
Yeah, that's a good point. And for future reference, if you ever want to write about me and you describe me like you described Dan Trayson, I'll be pretty stoked. You know, like, I thought she sounded pretty cool.
You know, but you'd be surprised. You'd be surprised at people who get pissed and what they get pissed about. But then you just kind of roll with it too. But, you know, in the end, I'm okay with people being pissed. I just want to feel confident in my heart that I did my best to get it, you know, get it right.
Yeah. One thing you mentioned was that, you know, when you write something as a writer, you're kind of on to the next at the point of publish. So that kind of makes me think, what is Mr. McDougall working on now after Harder Run 2?
Yeah, you know, it's kind of cool. I'm working on a book about body surfing. And one thing I've also gotten used to, I got used to two things. One is every book, someone will be pissed off. And number two, before you write every book, it's going to sound ridiculous. And so right now, like, oh, a book about body surfing, that's ridiculous. But it is cool, dude. Out here in Hawaii, it's a whole different game, man. Like what people are doing in the water, just their bodies and a pair of fins, it's wild. There's nothing you can do on a surfboard you can't do crazier without a surfboard.
That's interesting. I mean, I guess I've surfed a lot, but I've never really thought about the complexities of body surfing. That's you definitely piqued my interest with that.
So where have you surfed?
Well, I started surfing at Ocean Beach in San Francisco, which is, for anybody that hasn't surfed, it is the worst place in America to learn to surf. There's no sectioning, really short wave period, pretty big waves year round. There's not really a small season. It's a little smaller in the summer, huge in the winter, and pretty sharky. Yeah, pretty much any danger that exists, Ocean Beach has it.
Yeah, it's funny because I was actually supposed to be in a body surfing contest up there. It's Steamer Lane, which is just outside in Santa Cruz. Oh, no. And people were telling me, dude, you better get a really thick wetsuit. Like, a wetsuit? Really? Like, oh my God, you have no idea. Like a 4'3 wetsuit. Like 4'3, that's like what you wear to go to the moon, you know? And like, no, it's cold. Like, why would anybody do that? Cold. So now I get it. So have you ever surfed in Southern California, like around Newport Beach or anything like that?
Yeah, so I was living in a truck and, you know, made my way down there. I've done a couple surf trips in Southern California. I got to do Baja on a surf trip as well. And that was great. I also just did a jungle surfing trip down in Southern Mexico, which was cool. You know, I love surfing. I just think it was good for me to get baptism by fire, because now surfing is everywhere I go, the conditions are great to what I started in. It's like if you started trail running and for the first 2 years you only ran in 6-inch deep mud. So then after that, everything is spectacular conditions. You don't know any better. Everything's amazing.
Right. That is good. So I recommend a film for you called Dirty Old Wedge. Dirty Old Wedge is about surfing the wedge in Newport Beach. It's a body surfing only break. And I would say that, yeah. So when you were in Mexico, did you go to Puerto Escondido? Was that on your like Southern Mexico leg?
No, but that's not far from where I was. I was in a place called Zapote, which is near Zihuatanejo.
Yeah. I never body surfed in Mexico. I just the only place I know is Puerto Escondido because there's a contest there this summer I may go to. So check out Dirty Old Wedge, but I would be very curious to see if we revisit this conversation in a year whether you've come over to the body surfing side, because now, you know, you probably didn't see a lot of it in San Francisco because it'd be friggin' miserable to body surf up there. And the Southern California breaks are so choked with surfers, it really isn't a gap for a body surfer to sneak in. But in Hawaii, there's a lot of body surfing. And there are certain places like Point Panic that's body surfing only. And you see some wizards out there. And
Wow.
probably your point about getting out of the mud, on a trail, and then suddenly, like, oh my God, I got some hard pack. This is amazing. Same thing with body surfing. Like, now that you've been surfing and someone tells you, hey, dude, you don't need the board. You don't need the leash. You don't need a wetsuit. You just need some fins and a pair of, and a Speedo. When you try it, man, it is nuts. And then someone's gonna tell you, dude, you can get a long ass left, on balancing on your hand. You can do spins, you can do somersaults on your hand. You're gonna want to check it out. So that was one recommendation. Check out the film Dirty Old Wedge. And the second one is a book called, the book called Bone Games?
No, I don't.
Yeah, man. Check out Bone Games. It was written by a guy in Colorado. I forget his name, but he went in search of the flow state, the sense of that state you're in. And I think when we were discussing before, like the be hard versus the born to run mentality, I think Bone Games probably captured it better than I did, in the sense of, like, you can exceed your expectations for what you can accomplish, but by letting your body go, as opposed to trying to force it. And this, be hard, run until your liver collapses, versus breathe in, breathe out, let loose. You'll go faster, farther, and forever, as opposed to just grinding yourself into a fine powder. So yeah, Bone Games is a book, and Dirty Old Wedge is a film.
Do you remember the author of Bone Games?
Not off the top of my head, but yeah, if you Google it, it'll pop up in a heartbeat.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Sweet. I think as we begin to wrap up here, if I was listening to this and I was a person who was particularly just now getting into running, what was or what is one piece of advice that I could apply to my life right now from Christopher McDougall about beginning a relationship with running in general?
This is the hardest advice for people to take, and as soon as I say it, I know most people are going to stop listening. But it's this: it's focus on fun. Focus on fun. Every run, you should finish it feeling like that was the best time I ever had. And but people don't like to hear that. It comes from a mindset. It's the same conversation I have when people ask me about running shoes. And I start to tell them about minimalist shoes, and I get the, yeah, but my doctor says, yeah, but my feet are different. Yeah, but everybody likes to think that they are a special case and it has to be dangerous or painful. And I'm like, it doesn't. Focus on fun. So that focus on fun, when you break it down, go barefoot. Go barefoot. Barefoot's fun, dude. Nobody would rather wear shoes then go barefoot. The first thing you do when you get home, you take off your shoes, So you go to the beach, oh, take off my shoes. Everybody would rather go barefoot. Yeah, but what about the syringes? What about the glass? What about the this? What about my arches, Try it. Focus on the fun. If you can only go 50 yards barefoot, that's gonna be 50 fun yards, So that's my thing. If you want to develop a relationship with running, focus on fun. So my wife was getting into running. She's a dancer. And what she would do is, she thought running was boring, so she would get a bunch of books and put them in a backpack, and then just run around to various. There's like those little free libraries in people's front, end of the driveway, and so she's like, oh yeah, there's like a couple of these around here, so she'd get books out of the house she wanted to get rid of, drop them off in the free library, and then tell her, I'm only gonna bring back one, and there's a suspense because you go to the first one and you're tempted by Kurt Vonnegut, you're like, yeah, but what if there's a better one? Well, I'll take this one to the next one. So in her mind, it's like swapping books. I'll take the Vonnegut to the next one and maybe swap it out. Anyways, that's it's focusing on fun. At the end of the run, she doesn't know if she did 2 miles or 12 miles, you know, because she's stopping, she's looking at books, she's taking things out. And to me, like, that's just genius. That's focusing on fun. And then she can't wait to do it again. So that's it. Focus on the fun, man. And that's the secret to a lifetime of running.
I love that. I will share my version of your wife's strategy, which is collecting and foraging natural resources. I'm really into, you know, identifying plants, and I'll run out my front door. We have this big open space park in front of our house, and I'll just forage different plants. Some of them are natural sun lotions, some of them are edible, some of them I use for crafts. And I'll come home and my pockets will be full of, you know, tinder for the fire in the backyard. And then my other pocket's full of like a little bit of food and just all these different little things that I'm going and collecting on my run. And that's one way I like to do it.
Genius. Genius. Yeah. And your mind is actively engaged nonstop. And you don't want the run to end because you think, oh, what if there's a little like jewel plant a little further on, or it's like there's some mustard greens. If I just went another 50 yards. And so rather than the run, because most people on a run are focusing on like getting this thing over with, you know, like, oh, I get another mile to go. Yours is the opposite. Like, oh, shit, if I end now, I'm missing out on some good stuff, man. That's genius. That's terrific.
That's right. That's the motto. Well, Chris, thank you so much for fighting through our scheduling difficulties and hopping on here with me.
That was not an hour scheduling difficulty. That was a my scheduling difficulty. But thanks, Ryan. I appreciate it. Your forgiveness for me screwing up.
So if somebody's listening to this, what's a good place for them to learn more about, you know, the different stories that you're telling or what you've got going on?
Yeah, I'm pretty easy to find online. You know, we have Born to Run World is a site that Eric and I created with a lot of video content and info about, you know, running form and approach to running. And yeah, I'm on, you know, Instagram, Twitter. So look around, and I'm usually popping up here or there.
Right on, man. Yeah. Well, next time you're in Denver or Colorado at large, let me know and we'll go and have a fun run sometime.
I would love that. Actually, Ryan, let's make that a bucket list item for the two of us. I would love to go on a foraging run with you. So no, let's stay in touch and keep banging that around to find a time and a place.
All right, man. Well, thank you so much for coming by, and thank you everybody for listening.
All right, Ryan. Thanks a lot, buddy.